children, you go to jail.
Blog Talk Radio.
The streets don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your host, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
I gotta do right before they call me home.
Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is March 31st, 2010. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, the streets don't love you back. Join us each Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight with our special guest, Mr. Steve Novoychik from Arkansas. Steve has been in the public service for 30 years. He was named the youngest director of the first municipally operated ambulance service in the state of Arkansas, a position he held for 7 years. And during his time there, the ambulance service received the highest honors available for patient care and the operations of, by the operations of the Department of Health. He was also elected to serve as the coroner in two of Arkansas's most populated counties to serve 2 years as the director of the Arkansas State Crime Lab. And we're going to talk to Steve tonight and hear his story. And I would like to introduce to you Rob, my co-host.
Hey, hey, ladies and gentlemen. Like always, thank God for being here. And I thank God for Steve being blessed to come to the show and share his story with you all. And we're just going to get straight to the point tonight, and we're going to pass the mic to Steve, and he can formally introduce himself, and we can get straight started. Steve?
Well, I'm happy to be here. It's always wonderful to talk to people that are involved in activities on the street to make a difference, and I think that from what I've read about you, Boyd, and what you're doing, I think that, you know, you're somebody that's already, you walk the walk, and I think that's important for people to understand.
Right.
Yes, appreciate it, Steve. And, you know, God has blessed me and my wife to put this together, you know, and she's the moving force behind a lot of this. You know, I just wanted to let the audience know that. And she's a woman who works 24 hours at her regular job, and then she come home and put in time at the job we do together at the Streets Don't Love You Back movement. So I just want to give the wife a big shout-out for being so dedicated to what we do with our movement and to helping young youth and adults learn that as well. And I'm going to pass the mic over to her, and she can get the show on the road.
Well, I work 2 24-hours a week, so 48 hours a week. And I'm a critical care registered nurse, and I actually work for an ambulance service here in Phoenix. So that was kind of interesting. I had a question for you: How did you achieve that highest honor of, you know, the best patient care? What did you do with your staff to make them and help them have the best patient care?
You know, I was so young. We were all young when I was involved with the ambulance business. It was we had just taken over from the funeral homes, so that's how far back I go. I was looking the other day. I'm cleaning out a bunch of old stuff, and I was looking at my original license. My state EMT license was number 188, and I think they're up to, somebody said, like 60,000 now. So it was really a lot different back then. But we just had a bunch of young guys, and they were just, and some of them actually are, I've just reconnected with on this amazing tool called Facebook, you know, they're still in the ambulance business over there. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
A lot's changed, and as far as the ambulance stuff goes, I served for years on the Governor's Advisory Council on Emergency Medical Services, and we actually, the time frame that I was on it, was actually the time we promulgated the rules and regulations that are still, most of them are in operation today, and we actually, that was the beginning of the paramedic law, and so I was involved on the cusp of all those changes, and that in that field, and it was real exciting. I really enjoyed my time doing that and met a lot of good people, and they're still, you know, still have lots of good friends that are still doing it. Amazing.
Right. Good.
I let me tell you something. I could never begin to carry one of those carts or one of those stretchers. A gurney up and down stairs. My God. Yeah. Over in Hot Springs, it was a lot of old hotels, you know, and a lot of them didn't have elevators.
Wow.
So it was pretty unbelievable. And Hot Springs at the time had a heavy retired population. So the ambulance service kept busy. But I learned a lot doing it, I'll tell you.
Right. I hear you. I've sure learned a lot. I've been on it for 6 years, and I've seen a lot and learned a lot.
Yeah. So you're a critical care nurse too?
Right. That's what I do on the ambulance. We do mostly pre-hospital, from hospital to hospital. You know, occasionally we'll get involved in some traumas, but mostly the nurses do the pre-hospital transports of patients that are on ventilators and IV drips and things like that.
Oh, yeah. I tell you what, here in Little Rock, we got a horror story going on right now. It's unbelievable. two paramedic teams apparently missed the fact.
Saw that in the news today. Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely unbelievable. And I just can't imagine, you know, I've known a little bit about the business because I also was on the board of the local MEMS, which is the paramedic service here.
Right.
And, you know, I just can't imagine that happening. I mean, I know there's a lot of extenuating circumstances, and we don't know all the facts, and, you know, it's one of those kind of things, but it's just a bizarre, bizarre thing.
And it was two paramedics found a lady down, and they both pronounced her dead. And then coroner came along, and two different crews, and then the coroner, somebody else came along, and she was actually alive.
Yeah. And lived a couple of days. I was telling somebody the other day, as long as I've been in the death investigative business, which was over 20-something years, that was one of my greatest fears. I mean, I told you just now how long I've been doing this, and I actually became a deputy coroner in Garland County way back in the 70s, and that was before, you know, you had the life packs. That was before you had the paddles and all that business. So we were just winging it with stethoscopes. And over the years, there's been many times where I've, you know, been listening. And, you know, when you're excited and there's adrenaline pumping and gunpowder in the air and all of those sorts of things, sometimes you hear your own heartbeat in the stethoscope ears. And so, you know, I had people double check me all the time. We had one little old deputy coroner used to carry a mirror, and he'd stick it up to their nose. That's going back to the English days of coroners. But anyway,
wanted to make sure they wasn't alive.
That's right. No inspiration, expiration, and I think that's
my
the
man.
Old term. I was dusting off my EMT book the other day. But, you know, that's really kind of the way that I transitioned into what I'm doing now. It was sort of a long leap. But what happened was over the years, as I was doing the medical stuff, the coroner in the community where it was Hot Springs was about to retire, and I became a deputy. I was on nearly every major ambulance call anyway. And so I became a deputy coroner, and as the days wore on, I was really intrigued by the things that went through the investigation of a death, proper investigation of a death, and I was intrigued with how you know, when you in that instance, when you're dealing with family members, they're at their rawest emotion. So I got to see people at real honest times. You know, you're in the business, Lucinda, so you know when tragedy hits, people go to their rawest emotion, and you really learn a lot. So over the years studying death, I learned a lot about life. And so then as the years wore on, and as I moved through the job, various phases of my career, and I ended up being the coroner in Pulaski County, which is the capital of Arkansas. And I was here during the time that the street gang problem just exploded in the late 80s and early 90s. It was just out of control, and it was something that our community was relatively naive about it, and it really was something that people here didn't consider that could be a problem here in Arkansas and in Little Rock specifically. But from working the streets, I knew something was going on. I was seeing the same sort of graffiti, Boyd. You know all about that.
Yeah.
In the form of tattoos and brands on the bodies, and so so you know it just became a real intriguing thing to me. And as I was going through various homicide schools around the country at the same time, coincidentally or not so coincidentally, because this was happening all across the country at the same time, not just in Arkansas and in other places. Of course, it's been going on in Chicago and Detroit for 40 years, and the same thing out in Los Angeles, you know.
Right.
So those are sort of the contemporary, and the new things have sort of changed, but that was something we didn't think could happen here. But the first year that I took office as the coroner in Pulaski County, there were 38 homicides reported to our office in the entire county. We handled not just the city of Little Rock, but all the surrounding, about population of a little bit less than 500,000 in the entire county.
Right.
And that year of 83, there were 38 homicides. Now, compare that to 1993, 10 years later, when there were 111. And we didn't have a corresponding rise in our population base. It was just we had a huge increase in the number of people that were getting shot and killed.
Right.
And sadly, the biggest majority of those were young people, were under the age of 24. And, I mean, it was so... Our homicide rate here was so great per capita, it was greater than New York City and Los Angeles at the time.
Right.
We had so many kids being shot up, and well, not just kids, but you know, young adults as well. That Army sent surgeons here to train at Children's Hospital. I mean, it was crazy. It was a crazy era,
right.
And finally, people began to understand that you could not just effectively deal with this issue with guns and jails and police.
Right.
We need those guys. We need the guns. We need the jails. We need the police because, frankly, you know, there's some kids out here that will kill you because of just the way you look at them. And, I mean,
exactly.
You know, there are really some dangerous folks on the street.
Right.
I just wanted to ask you,
I listened to you when you said that things started happening around the 83, and then 10 years later, it was still happening major. I just wanted to ask you this right here. When the problem first hit in Little Rock, because I've never been to Little Rock, but heard about it down there, you know,
yeah.
It was kind of a slow country. Is that kind of correct?
Right, and see, that was one of the things that really, that I saw escalate some of the problem on the street. You know, when you talk to a kid or a young person and you tell them that when I do my little lectures and speak at places, I tell people to throw the word wannabe out of their lexicon because that's a disarming word. I call these kids gonna-bes, and I also tell them that if they're acting that way and doing those things, that's what they think they are. So one of the things that happened is that was sort of the reputation that, and that was a diss to a lot of these local gangs, you know. So they felt like they had to prove, they had to be a little meaner than they were in other places to prove that Little Rock wasn't a slow, backwards place.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Well,
because, you know, it's all about their reputation on the street. And that was a big thing about it is, you know, a lot of the reputations embellished and those sorts of things. But we really had the horrible dynamic here. And Boyd and Lucinda, what some of the reason that it was so violent back in the early 90s is because it was so new that the particular gangs were cutting up the turf. So there was a lot of violence over the turf wars, you know, carving out their drug territories and their home turf. So there was a great deal of violence during that era, and that sort of subsided. But it subsided not only because the city woke up and began doing not only effective law enforcement, they began to do a different kind of law enforcement. They began to do, you know, the old style community oriented policing, a lot of bicycle police officers. You know, they were really starting to make some changes and I'll politicize this for just a minute, but they were really making effective, good changes during the Clinton years. because President Clinton recognized the importance of balancing suppression and enforcement with intervention and prevention. So there were a lot of wonderful intervention and prevention programs that were funded not only nationally through tax dollars, but through foundations and through the positive movement in the government that was moving that direction on prevention and intervention. That made a huge difference in not only in Little Rock, but all across the nation when juvenile crime began to dip and the numbers began to go down and we began to see other things happening, you know, grade point averages going up. Well, then along came the war.
Right.
And when the war came along, where did our monies go? Where did the priority in spending?
The priority went across the water and not here in our own state, you know?
And that's right.
And so
what happened was, is now the reason we're beginning to see this uptick again is because the children that we were reaching with those strong intervention, prevention, and treatment programs over the years are becoming teenagers now. They're becoming,
exactly. You
know, the 13, 14, 15-year-olds, and we quit doing the intervention and prevention with them when they were 5, 6, and 7 years old. When
right.
we know, when evidence shows, that that's when you have to start working on these young folks.
Very
you
young.
You can't wait until they're in the 8th grade. That's too
Thank
late.
Thank you. I agree with that.
You have to start in grade school. Now, let me tell you something. We know in the youth service business that the single greatest predictor of a child's involvement in the DYS system, getting into the system, whatever it's called in wherever you are, into the youth system, the single biggest predictor is early referrals at school to the principal's office.
Right.
For minor things that go uncorrected and over the years they get worse and worse. So we know evidence shows that is the biggest single predictor of a child's involvement in the youth services business, in the division of youth services, is when they start in school. So what that tells me is schools have to begin doing a better job. Schools have to begin recognizing those things and directing treatment and prevention and intervention programming toward those young people, not only the schools, but the entire community.
And that's correct.
Schools a lot of times get the rap for having bad kids, but people have to remember schools are simply a snapshot of the community. You know, what's happening in the schools is happening in the entire community. That's where it begins, and then it comes to the school, and that's where it manifests itself because that's when you bring all the kids together. So
exactly.
Schools are in a wonderful position, but they also have to have the support of the entire community. The community has to understand the issue. The community has to understand that it's very important and imperative that we keep these kids in our own community, that we deal with them here because we know them, we can deal with them. So that means people are going to have to step up to the plate. Now, that's
right.
a costly system that I'm talking about. I'm talking about a total system of care because, Lucinda, let me ask you something. Do you think these kids on the street are born that way?
No, they're not.
They learn that. And so here's what I tell folks, and this
right.
is a crazy analogy. But the analogy is everybody in your audience, I bet, because of the people that listen to your show, are probably pet lovers. And they know that during the summer when their pet gets fleas on them, they put all that expensive business on them. They take them, get them to the vet. They do all that sort of thing. But if you don't treat where that dog sleeps at night, they get fleas all over them again. You can spend $100 on them a day.
Man.
But if you don't treat that little pet. So what we have to do is we have to recognize as communities, we have to recognize that there are kids that we are trying to help, that the schools are trying to help, that all of these programs effectively are dipping day in and day out into the dog dip, but we send them right back into the community where their parents are, you know, might be starving, where their parents are having to sell drugs to survive, where their parents are not together, where, you know, we send them back to these areas where these children, what I call the 5-H club. The 5-H's are helpless, mm-hmm. hopeless, homeless, hungry, and hugless. And many mm-hmm. of the kids that I've dealt with in the gang world come from that environment. And so what we have to recognize is we have to help the children. And if we help the children can help us help the family. And families can make stronger neighborhoods and communities. I mean, it's just a it seems to me that it's a simple fix that people are just missing it. You know, it just
right. They're jumping over the loop, Steve.
Right, and you got so much bureaucracy, and you got so many things. One of the things that we know works, and here's one of those things. Here's one of those areas where you say, how can you prove that what you did with Johnny when he was seven? How can you prove that the program that this former gang member operates here in our community, LaFell Jackson, operates a program called Rockin', Reaching Our Children and Neighborhoods, and he's a former Crip leader. And so now he's got these kids that he's working with day in and day out in the prevention and intervention mode, teaching them how to cook, teaching them, you know, they go home and help their parents. This is a wonderful program. The only thing it costs parents for their kids to participate in that program is they have to give 1 hour a week. They have to, so if their child's there in that aftercare facility or after school facility, then all they got to do is come and read to the kids for 1 hour a week or help clean or help cook or whatever. But it's an amazing program. But where I'm going with this is, how can we prove what LaFell's doing with somebody when they're 8 years old kept them from killing somebody when they were 16? We can't prove it, but we know it happened. So we know that mentoring, and that's where I want to go in just a minute. Now I'll shut up and let y'all talk. But mentoring,
now, do your
is
thing,
something,
Steve.
That, mentoring is something that we know works. Mentoring is something that every community has the capability of doing. There's a wonderful website. It's mentoring.org that will tell you how to do this. But now here's what you got to understand, and here's one of the exciting kind of projects that I'm working on here. A lot of people are actually working on it. I just happen to be the one that kind of pulled everybody together. We know that in the system, all right, let's say that where do you live in Phoenix, you said?
I'm actually
where you are?
I'm in
Phoenix.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So in Phoenix, we know, whatever your system is out there, that Johnny is going to be coming back to 802 A Street. And when he comes into our system, we know that he's coming. So what we want to do is identify a mentor from the community where he's going to come from that will begin working with him from the time he comes into our system. All right? So what you are building right there is a bridge back to his neighborhood. Now, while that mentor is working with that child in the facility or wherever, however your system works, you also have some people in the community that are working with that child's family as family mentors. You know, sometimes, like we had a child here who was constantly picked on in school, and he smelled bad. And when I went to visit the house to see why he smelled bad, it was because their plumbing didn't work. It wasn't because, and the mother couldn't afford a plumber, and so they were just living, you know, kind of a horrible existence. And so all we did was we got a church right around the corner to come down and fix the plumbing. And that made a world of difference, you know, and that was just a simple little act of somebody reaching out. One of the things, too, that I get in trouble from time to time is when I talk to ministers, and I had lunch with a minister friend of mine the other day, and he was telling me how much money that his church, and I'm talking a substantial amount of money, $250,000 or more, but how much that they had sent to Haiti. Now, what's going on in Haiti is horrible, and it's wonderful, and it's nice, you know, and it makes you feel good that you're helping. But I asked him, I said, did you know that right around the corner, I can take you six blocks from your church, and there is a family that lives just like families that live in third world countries. Did you know that? And he had no idea. He said, no, you're kidding. I said, let's go. I'll take you right down here, and I'll introduce you to these folks. They're very nice folks. They're doing the best they can with what they got to work with, but they're just living a sad existence. So I think that many times in many communities, a lot of churches lose sight of the fact that they don't have to go overseas to help people. There's a lot of people right here that
I think everybody forgets that. You know, why couldn't all the stars get together and throw a benefit to support the homeless or the kids that need school clothes that are homeless or you know, or families like that just don't have the basic necessities. You know, they forget about that, and yet they're willing to do it, you know, for all the big the big things that happen, but what about the everyday things that people need here?
Well, I think it all boils down to, frankly, publicity. I mean, you know, when big things happen, people have a tendency to get your attention. I mean, you think about that. I tell you, I was mesmerized that day that kid got, or we thought the kid was in the balloon. You know, that sort of thing gets your attention because the media focuses on it. But sooner or later, you know, when if you're living in a community where they have a high homicide rate or a lot of crime, it just gets to be sort of mundane every day. You know, you just sort of get used to it, and you seem to kind of forget about it. And so that's why every community needs activists. That's why every community needs somebody that advocates for the children in the community. Every community needs somebody that just gets out there and is not afraid of what people are going to say, think, or do, is not going to be worried about people wondering about what their motives are, because you know most people that are doing this are, they have true motives. I mean, their motive is just simply to try and help people. But that's the way you're going to change things. I mean, you know, and people have to be, they can't be afraid to speak up. There's some studies released today. I don't know if you saw them on Facebook, but there's some studies released today that talk about the number of kids that are going into the system that have alcohol and drug abuse problems. And a lot of places don't even screen for that. We ask questions on assessment, but, you know, you don't do an excessive screening. And then we also know that a lot of these kids that are coming into facilities around the country are dual diagnosed. They have, you know, severe depression and all sorts of other sorts of things. You know, there was a lot of people can't really grasp this until they hear this figure, but there was a study not long ago in the Los Angeles school district that said almost 40% of the kids in the school district suffered from PTSD, from post-traumatic stress. Can you imagine that?
I can't even imagine that, Steve, in this area.
It's unbelievable. And then when you expect, and then, so how do we expect those kids to learn, you know, if they're afraid? And if they go to school afraid, and if they live afraid. That's one of the questions when I do school assemblies or when I go speak at facilities or wherever. And I just spoke at one the other day, and I asked the kids in the crowd, I said, probably crowded, oh, I'd say 80 young people. I said, how many of y'all live in a neighborhood where you hear gunshots? And about half the hands went up. The adults in the rooms are always shocked, you know, when that happens. But, you know, there's some communities where gunshots are just...
They're in shock. They're, like, really in denial. Because if they hear those gunshots, they know what's going on, too.
Yeah. Well, and you know, some kids are just immune to it, too. I mean, they just hear it so much.
Right.
You know, in Chicago, I went up there one time, and you know about Cabrini Green, boys.
Yeah, my cousin used to be in Vice Lloyd's up in Cabrini Green. We used to go up there
really?
When I was a kid in the 70s. We used to go up there every summer in the Cabrini Green projects, yeah.
Well, I'm telling you, it was a tough place.
Place too, Steve.
Oh, man. I was up there. I was with some gang officers, and we sat outside Cabrini Green, and they said that we were out real early in the morning. They said, we're going out early tomorrow. So we sat outside and watched. And it was almost like it was real surreal because all the adults started coming out of the apartments and they lined up the sidewalk. You know, they just formed a human shield so the kids could walk to the school bus. And because of the gunshots, the adults were acting as their bullet, you know, the bullet shield. It was unbelievable. I mean, I was just, and then, you know, you go into other places, and I'm not just talking about big cities, you know, Chicago and Detroit and Los Angeles and Dallas and Little Rock, wherever. You can go anywhere and you can find that, you know, something that's like that. That's just really is so, I mean.
It's epidemic in every ghetto across America, you know?
Yeah, and it's sad. It's sad to see folks living like that. It's sad. And then we wonder, you know, you wonder why people commit crime. I try to convince people when I talk to them about this that you have to put aside your belief system, you have to put aside your reality, and you have to get in that child's reality.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
To me and you, it's illegal to stand on the street corner and sell drugs.
Right.
To a kid that's in the 5-H club, that's 9 years old, that's mother is on crack, whose father isn't in the house. She's been helping to feed and clothe her baby brothers and sisters for 3 days while mom's been gone.
It's right to them.
Yeah. So is it right for her to go out and sell? It's illegal as hell. She shouldn't be doing it. But if that's the only way she can feed her brothers and sisters, and
she's gonna be out there.
That 9-year-old girl's gonna be out there slinging,
all day,
selling her body, or doing whatever it takes. And it's just a matter of survival to many young people. So now, the bleeding heart liberals like me, I guess I am one. It's because I've seen that, and I can tell you that hungry, hopeless people do bad things.
Right.
So, you know, there just has to be, and we've created sort of this culture of, I don't know, sickness in this country. I'm not really sure but I tell you, I'm also real worried about politics in this country. I think, you know,
right. I definitely got to say I'm worried about politics too, Steve.
Well, you know,
the simple fact.
Boys, let me tell you, the kids see what's going on. They see all this screaming and hollering and finger pointing and name calling and all that stuff. I had a kid tell me this was crazy. We had, I forget who these two candidates were, but I think they were running for U.S. Congress over in the eastern part of the state, and they were at a debate, and these two candidates got in a shoving match on stage. And, of course, it made big news. You know, I don't remember. It wasn't a very much of a shoving match, but, I mean, they made contact, and it was a news story, and there was video of it and all that. So for the next 3 or 4 days, I was out on the street, you know, trying to negotiate with these kids about all this retaliation and, you know, just to try and get them to quit killing one another,
right,
basically. And one guy said, well, how do you expect us to get our crap together when you guys can't get it together? And he called, he told me about that news story. So, you know, kids watch the news. They see that. So, you know, I gave the keynote address to the United States Conference of Attorneys General several years ago, and I was out in Long Beach is where it was, and the only line, and I always kind of laughingly say this because it wasn't really a brilliant speech, but I always tell people when I'm talking that the only line from my quite brilliant speech that I gave to these 50 attorney generals from across the United States, about half of them Republican, about half of them Democrat. And I made the comment in there that I'd been in this room with them for half a day, and I said, last week I spent a half a day in a room with 50 Crips and Bloods, and I got to tell y'all, there's no difference in the dynamics of these two rooms because everybody is all about respect, reputation, and retaliation. And when you
and
think
power
about that,
and control.
Yeah. And those three R's, respect, reputation, and retaliation, I always tell people that's the three R's of gang. That's what drives us. And, you know,
right.
And on the street, it's just we used to could tell people that tracked it here. We knew that when something happened in one part of town, we could predict within a reasonable degree of certainty where the next shooting was going to take place, you know, in what vicinity, or at least who the targets were going to be, because they were also interconnected, and that's what frequently happens in communities too. So that points to a need for people to really work real hard on peer mediation, on dealing with, you know, problem solving. So that should be done at a young age. We should learn from all these things that we, you know, these mistakes we've made over the years. And we're cycling back into it now. I told President Clinton, called me a couple, year and a half or 2 years ago and met with me, and he asked about it. He said, what do you think, what's happening again? I said, I think three things are happening. I think, number one, I think the economy. When your economy's bad, crime goes up. And everything related to crime goes up. I mean, the whole drugs, everything. The second thing is we've got a lot of people who went to prison back in the get tough days, the zero tolerance days, and they're coming out now, and not a lot of those prisoners get a lot of support to rehabilitate themselves in prison. You have to want to rehabilitate yourself in prison, Boyd. You know, right?
I know.
I know you know. They offer you the things to do that with, and some take that, but some don't.
A lot of them
don't,
Steve.
A lot of them sit back and just do their time talking
shit all day and swapping, you know, war stories, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And can't wait to get out and do the same thing.
Right. Now, so a guy's been in 8, 10 years, all right? everything's changed on the street, right, boy?
So immediately.
When this guy comes out and he wants to reassert control or whatever happens, there's been a power shift.
Right.
So that's going to automatically create some violence. There's going to
get him going strong.
That's right. There's going to be some violence over that for him to get reestablished.
Right.
So then you're going to start seeing that. So that's what's happening. And the other thing that those guys are doing is see while all these bad guys and the organized gangsters, the real gangsters, were locked up and gone quiet on the street, these little neighborhood groups started growing again. No real connections. They didn't have, I mean, we had this little bunch here in North Little Rock called themselves the 2200 Click because of the street where they lived. That was their street number.
Right.
Well, we didn't see any sort of organized activity until one day I saw a six-pointed star in their 2200 stuff. And then the next day I saw a couple of pitchforks. Then the next day, I started seeing some. So I said, well, somebody is organizing them, or someone older has stepped into the picture, which is what had happened.
Right.
Now, then the third thing I told him was, besides the fact that the people are getting out and recruiting, and it's just kind of being popular again, and it's trendy. You know, a lot of this gang, they're calling themselves different things. We're not gangs. We're crews or we're cliques. But you know, you can dress a pig up in a $500 suit and put lipstick on her and name her Monique and take her home to introduce your parents. In the end, she's still a pig, right?
Right.
Well, that's what's happening.
I know it.
And that's exactly what's happening here. You know, a lot of these people are saying, "Oh, we're not a gang. We're just a crew." Well, are you shooting people? Yeah. Well, yeah. Are you claiming turf? Well, yeah, yeah. Got hand signed? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, quack quack. You're a duck.
Right.
Anyway.
That's real, bro, Steve. My man. That's real tough, man.
All right, so the third thing, here's the third thing. We got the other two things I said. I'm getting so old I hide my own Easter eggs, but I know I got two down, and I know what the third one is. The third one is it's just a simple matter of mathematics. And the simple matter of mathematics are the average age of a murderer in this country is 20. The average age of a burglar is 16. We have more 16- and 20-year-olds now than we ever have had.
Right.
And a lot of those 16- and 20-year-olds have grown up without the proper guide in their life.
Period.
And you know, so that all of those things are happening again. Is it, you know, am I saying no, you know, get ready, the sky's falling? No, but I'm saying what communities had better recognize is they have to start addressing this, looking at it as a total system of care. You have to help the entire neighborhood. You can't just be expected to help kids and offer kids positive things. You have to build up the neighborhood. And,
right.
You know, there's a lot of things that can happen. There's a lot of creative things out there. The mentoring thing I was telling you about, there's a lot of money coming available through the Second Chance Act. There is a big push now. I will tell you this, that in the past there has been a sort of unwritten, unspoken about separation where when it came to federal grants and grant monies, that faith-based and government grants didn't mingle. Now they mingle. Now it's almost a guarantee that if you want to get a large successful mentoring grant or a lot of social service grants, you have to have a faith-based component in it. And so that's something that is changing that people need to listen to in communities. And I know there's a lot of churches that refuse to take government money, but I think at least here in our state, we're really taking a step back and we're saying, look, we're here to technically assist you. Here's what our goal is. We want to help kids. We want to find kids jobs. We want to get kids parents jobs. We want to make things better. And we can't do that. We don't have the money to do that. But we can help inspire your community to do it. We can help tie you together to do that. And that's really what every community needs to do. And you can do that on a local level. When I was at the city, after I left the coroner's job at the end of '94, I traveled around the country for about 6 years. And then in 2001, I went to work for the city of North Little Rock as the youth services director. And one of the things that I did is began forming this, what we call the Youth Services Advisory Council, which was essentially just a group of people in the community that we identified through the mayor's office as a group of people who delivered services to youth. and they were people from lots of different disciplines. The health department, we knew they were involved. We pulled in just everybody, government agencies, church groups, Boys and Girls Club, Salvation Army. You know, we had everybody in the community at the table that actually delivered youth services, and we identified problems. Now, I left that job, and a young man by the name of Bray Cloud took over as the director of youth services, and he continued, and under his aegis, that program, that little youth service advisory council program, was awarded one of the 30 best prevention programs in the United States by the U.S. Conference of Mayors.
My man.
And it was a simple little thing. He's a smart man. He's off at Harvard right now. But you know, that was a simple little thing that we put together and thought out, and he executed after I left. And I mean, it was just an amazing thing to see happen how they put that. Now, North Little Rock is a relatively small community of 60,000 people. But there's no reason that can't work in different areas. If you're in a large community, that could work in a borough or in a ward or a precinct or whatever you have in your community. You know, but you have to have somebody at the hub of it that is willing to spend the time tying all of those resources together. That's how you help your neighborhood, you know. So.
And that's the bottom line, Steve. And we just want to say tonight, you know, for the people who's out there listening, we definitely want you to be truly enlightened at what Steve has been talking about tonight, because, you know, it's not just a Little Rock problem. Like you said, it's a global problem with this whole situation out here. And for you churches and you other organizations in every town across America, we want you to start looking at what's happening on your block. You know, we understand that you own TV and you see all this big disaster happening across in other countries. It's fine, you send a few dollars, but what about the man around the corner that can't feed his family? You know, start taking him a few dollars around his spot too. You know, if you can take $100,000 and send across the water, and it's not no disrespect, but it's just real reality. You know. And gangs will start at 7, 8 years old. You know, it ain't no I'm waiting till I'm 15. You know, I started being in a gang when I was 10 years old. So it starts very young, people, and stop turning a blind eye to what's really going on in America, you know. So we're going to take a break right quick. We're going to come with a song and a commercial, and we'll be right back with my main man, Steve. You know, just hold on right quick. We'll be right back.
The money. The rise to power, violence, gangs, drugs, death, self-destruction, prison. The true life story of Detroit kingpin Rob Boyd. A must-read book. This book will be available online, worldwide, to order at thestreetsdontloveyouback.name.com, at amazon.com. BarnesandNoble.com, IndieBound.org, and Borders.com. Also available in Detroit at Harlem World Books and Videos and at Humane Bookstore on Frederick Douglass Boulevard. It's everywhere, so go ahead and order your autographed copy today. The streets don't love you back.
Yeah, yeah, this the Streets Don't Love You Back. We dedicate this to all the youths across America, all those who've been abandoned by their parents and loved ones. We let you know that God is good, always. Even when no one else cares, He's there for you.
Oh,
keep your head up.
Hey, the streets don't love you back. I hear grinding in a life of crime. The streets don't love you back. Show me what rules, baby, I'm gonna get mine. The streets don't love you back. Show me what way on this lonely road. The streets don't love you back. I gotta do right before they call me home. The streets don't
never love you.
This is Rob Boyd checking in, letting you know the streets will never ever love you back.
When I was abandoned by my father in this world, when I was abandoned by the man that I thought loved me, it took my whole life in another direction, my mind. How can you say that you love me in this world. Never did nothing for me or my mama or my sister in this world. How can you look at yourself and be proud of what you've done? Now I say to myself, as a little child, I went to the street world, and I had to learn that it didn't love me back. Now I look at life so much in a different frame, my mind. Now I know the streets will never love me back. I thank God for what he done for me, 'cause I listened to my mama in this world. Now I tell all the children, all the little boys and girls, the streets will never love you, will never love you back.
The streets don't love me back. I hear grinding in a life of crime. The streets don't love you back. There's only one rule, baby, I'ma get mine. The streets don't love you back. There's only one way, on the stone and gold. The streets don't love you back. Gotta do right before they call me home.
I know it's gonna change the way your young mind thinks, and I know you wanna lounge, smoke weed and drink. And I really ain't all the type to give a speech or preach, but I promise God that I would do this if he get me out the street. See, when I was coming up, motherfuckers was loyal, but now they cracking under pressure when the situation boils and comes to a head. Another fork in the road, everyone got affidavits, show their codies told. They wasn't scared to do the crime, but now these motherfuckers cowards. The county was one thing, but now it's no more private showers. It's all in the open, better learn to be a man. Fuck all the pistol popping, yapping, shit or learn to use your hands. Went from pod storms to day rooms to mess halls and rec yards. You think you something special, everybody's got it hard. Penitentiary ain't like it is on TV, and a fair joint is something hope you never have to see. I don't care how tough you think you are to humble your ass. They got a room especially for you just to beat your ass. Shit sad, it's hard, raised by the streets with no dad. But going life with death and pressure ain't gonna never change the past, 'cause
yeah, ladies and gentlemen, I like to dedicate this track to my mother, my brothers, my sister, to my man LD, his wife Holly, to my manager Lucinda, to my two sons, Michael and Robert. Dedicate this to my homeboys, the Bishop Crew off Van Eyck and Harper, the Brewster Project, my man Chickaria, Warner County Project, 430 Crew, Day and Fab, rest in peace. Let's do this. You live on through my vision. The streets don't love you back. One of your own made it. Now we tell the world, the streets will never love you back. Change your ways. Change your ways. Change your ways.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome right back here to the Streets on Love You Back radio show. Kicking it right here with my man Steve. And we back with Steve, live, living in color like we promised you. And I just want to get back to you, Steve, and I just wanted to say what enlightenment and what kind of encouragement would you give these youths and adults and these parents out here? What kind of, you know, enlightenment would you give them as far as encouragement?
Well, I guess, like we all heard when we were kids, you can do it if you want to. You know, if you want it bad enough, there's ways that you can get things. You can get out of whatever situation you're in, but you have to talk to people about it. Young people can't be expected to make all those good decisions without leaning on somebody that's older than them. So whatever problem that they've got, they need to talk to somebody that they trust about it. And as far as adults in the community, I think they just need to take a step back and look at themselves in the mirror and ask, am I part of the problem or am I part of the solution? And what am I doing if I'm not really part of the problem? What can I do to be part of the solution? It's real simple. There's a lot of good things going on in every community. There's a lot of good, you know, churches doing wonderful things. There's a lot of good programs that are doing wonderful things. And there are a lot of just good, hardworking people in communities. So it's always easy to hook up with somebody that's doing that, and most community has some sort of resource, you know, that people can do it, but you can do it simply by calling the Boys and Girls Club or going down to the local church or, you know, just picking up the phone and calling the school. Or a simple little thing like you don't have to change your whole life around. Just tell your kid to bring some kid from school that doesn't get to do much of that kind of stuff and take them to the ball game or take them to fishing or take them, you know, whatever you're doing with your kid, you're going to be doing it anyway. Just have them bring along a friend.
Right.
So that's an easy way to mentor kids, you know. Doesn't take anything to do that.
My man, and that's a good suggestion to the people that's listening to the show. And once again, our parents have to truly get involved out here and stop, once again, like we say, turning a blind eye to, like, little Johnny ain't doing this or little Susie ain't doing that, you know. You have to get involved with your children. You have to know what's going on around you at all given times. And for the parents that's out here doing good in the communities and all reaching out to the children, we want to give you a big hands up for being encouraged to do that. And the ones who are not doing that, we want to tell you to get up off your behind and start getting involved in what's happening and stop sitting back chilling, you know? And
There are people doing wonderful things everywhere. You're right, you know, and they can share that. I've got a YouTube site, YouTube channel. I was going to tell people if they want to email me, it's real easy. It's steve@gangwar.com. And then I can give them links to my YouTube channel and all that, because there's a lot of good stuff on there about programs around the country that are doing great things. And then there's another couple of resource sites that I've got that I'll send them if they're interested. All they got to do is send me an email.
My man, and give them your email address, Steve.
Steve@gangwar.com. Steve@gangwar.com. My
right.
Website, gangwar.com. But if they'll email me, I'll send them back the links to the YouTube channel and all that. And there's a wealth of data on there. Boyd, I put that thing on there I told you about, Mad Dads.
Yeah.
I loaded it up tonight, so it's on there now.
Okay, I'll get a chance to go see that and grab that, and I'll put that on me and my wife's movement page and get that out there as well, you know. So, once again, we hope everyone is truly being enlightened to what's happening today on the show, because like we just discussed tonight, we have to be that spoken voice. We have to be that loud voice in our community. We can't just be that one peeking out the window, and when we hear somebody walking down the street and trying to see and hear everything, we got to be out there involved, you know what I mean? And that's what makes a big difference out in this world, getting involved and not just shilling yourself behind the curtain and looking out the curtain. So let's get involved, my people, and let's do what we need to do. And for people that don't know, once again, Mr. Steve information is on his website. Go check the website out. And in Little Rock, Arkansas, we want to give you a big shout out. And I want to give a big shout out to my man, Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton. I received 3 honors from Bill Clinton back in 1996 and 97. So I want to give big shout outs to my boy Bill Clinton, you know what I mean, for his support, what I do for the homeless for these past 20 years. So I want to give you much love, Bill, on that, man. You know, you and Hillary was real, real, real good to me during your time in the office, you know. So that's peace and love and big ups to your town, you know.
Yeah, we'd like to let you know that part of the proceeds from all of our books and all that we do go to either the homeless or our scholarship fund to, you know, so that we can reach out and help others.
That's great.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, too, that, you know, I think our communities need more parenting classes. You know, they make you go to a parenting class when you're getting divorced, and that's the only time I've really seen it. Or maybe if your kids are in trouble with the law, they might make you. But when you're just first married, you know, there should be parenting classes, because a lot of times you don't really know how to be a parent. And a lot of it is about communication.
I think that's a splendid idea, and I bet there's a bunch of churches out there with a bunch of successful marriages that could become mentoring parents.
Right.
Teach you how to be a good parent. So
right.
you don't have to report to the health department to do that.
Exactly. You don't have to wait till you're getting divorced to go to one either. You know?
Go around to the church and talk to them.
Learn how to talk to your kids. Learn how to communicate.
Right.
And you know, learn to look for warning signs when your kids are in trouble.
That's right. Bob, you talk to Myrtle and Bob, say, how are you so successful? Bob says, well, you know, I get the last word every time. Yes, dear.
My
bad. That's why I've been successfully married for 36 years. That's why Myrtle's my friend.
Right, right. Because I on Thursday right, say yes, ma'am.
It's been a real pleasure. And like I said, people can email me at steve@gangwar.com, and I will hook them up. And if they're Facebook people, they can. I think you can just go on that search and put in Gang War, and the little Gang War Prevention Facebook page pops up. And I'm not sure how this technology works. I just know that you punch buttons and you click enter and things happen, and it's real kind of real exciting to this old guy. But that's a cat.
And
all right. If I can ever help anybody now, no kidding, just give me a call.
All right. And you got all Steve information, and we want you to always be enlightened and tuned that you can make a difference in your community and you can make a difference in someone's life, you know. And before Mr. Steve get off the line, we're going to go with one more song, and it's called Minor Adjustments by Artist Pretty Cool.
Hey, baby. You know we came a very long way together. You've been the strongest thing I've ever seen. I know times ain't been perfect, but together we stand. Survive on the water. But when you survive,
I don't want you to
Ladies and gentlemen, that's a track by my man Pretty Cool, Minor Adjustments. And a lot of you people out there need a true minor adjustment. So definitely take a look at life, at getting life adjusted for yourself out here, you know. And we want to thank you, Mr. Steve, for coming to the show. And we would just like to say keep up the good work you've been doing all over these years. And we're sending you peace and love down there in Arkansas to you and your family.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure. Talk to you later.
All right, be good.
Thank you. Right. We'd also like to thank all the listeners for listening tonight. And as usual, every Wednesday night we'll be on with a special guest and a different topic. Join us next Wednesday night with author Karen Dabney. She's out of Detroit, Michigan. And we want to wish everyone a happy Easter this weekend. Be safe and remember that the streets don't love you back. Join us next Wednesday night and also on our website at www.thestreetsdontloveyouback.ning.com.
All right. Have a good night.